Good afternoon, Mr. Gibson.
Hello, Eileen.
The last time we met, you had just arrived in Palace Barracks, Northern Ireland, and you had to report, you were told to report to the adjutant in the morning?
That's absolutely correct. That's the first thing that I recall arriving by ferry into Belfast, and came off the ferry and was immediately hustled into the back of a pig and driven pretty quickly through Belfast to Palace Barracks, which is just on the outskirts, on the southern side of Belfast, Hollywood. And all you could see of Belfast was a little rectangle of light coming in the back door of the pig, and all you saw was sort of cars and buildings flashing past you. And really that was my first experience, and a bit tentative, a bit nervous about everything perhaps that was going on, because I finished Platoon Commander's Battle Course, and obviously there had been quite an active period in Belfast with the IRA taking on the troops in various areas, improvised explosives devices. So I was conscious that there was an active campaign of terrorism against the British Army in Belfast at that particular time, in fact throughout the province. So I was slightly nervous as to what to expect, but I had my suitcase and my kit bag with me, and it was bundled in and driven to Palace Barracks. We arrived there actually quite late, I recall, and the first thing we did was turned up at the officer's mess and went in there and were shown my room, which I got a nice, huge, great room, but I was sharing it with a lovely guy called Sandy Boswell from the Argyles, who was attached to us. So he was obviously a bit more senior to me, but he and I were put in there. And if I recall right, the mess colour sergeant, I think, was Colour Sergeant John Sevright, who, funnily enough, now lives just a couple of miles from me in Keith, in the northeast of Scotland here. And we still see each other quite often, but I'm sure John Sevright was my first mess colour sergeant. But he certainly kept us right, and we were fired upstairs to this room and, just unpacked, and then went downstairs and met up with some of the guys who were there and had dinner. And I think they had a couple of drinks, and then that was it, to bed. And the next morning, breakfast bright and early, smartened up in my combats on and my green denim trousers with the smart sort of lead weights in the bottom and your putties to make them look smart. That's what the commanding officer liked. And marched into the adjutant, who was Captain Ian Chance Semple. I don't think he'd been adjutant for that long, actually, because Andrew Forbes was the adjutant before him, who I recall from Fort George days when I turned up there. I saw the adjutant, and he sort of welcomed me into the fold, gave me all the adjutantal-type things that you must not do, which always, I think I look back now and think, God, nothing's changed, really. You get this list of things you mustn't do, forgetting you perhaps about the things that you ought to do. But then I was taken off and went to see my new company, which was a support company, commanded by Major Derek Napier. And indeed, Derek and I now work together as trustees, which is quite nice, of the Highlanders. So it's sort of gone full circle. And I was just thinking the other day, Derek Napier wrote to me about something, and he said that he was due to retire in a few months' time. And I wrote back saying, I can't believe you're approaching 65, because it seems like yesterday that you used to kick my butt around the barracks at Palace Barracks. And so there's a bit of mutual laughter about that. But so I turned up there and saw my company commander and my company sergeant major. I think it was a Mr. McGill, Sergeant Major McGill, who made sure we were all squared away and put on the correct course. So that was an interesting sort of first day. It was only about 10 o'clock by now, and I'd sort of got the guided tour of the camp, which wasn't a large camp, but it did house a lot of stuff within it, as I think we've discussed before. But it was a good introduction, and I was advised that I would be taking over what was described as a recce platoon from the then Lieutenant Douglas Collin, shortly to be Captain Douglas Collin, and he was being posted away to Brecon, I think it was, as an instructor at Brecon, the platoon sergeant's battle course. So I went and met the recce platoon, met Douglas Collin briefly, because he had to basically dash. So I didn't see very much of him. I was left in the very capable hands of Sergeant Robbie Forty, Ian Robertson Forty. And he introduced me to the platoon, and I was conscious that recce platoons were normally the senior platoon. They were some very experienced guys in the platoon, and so I was a little concerned, because these guys had seen it all, done it all, eaten it for breakfast, had the t-shirt, everything. The only thing was that, of course, this is Northern Ireland, and they weren't acting in a recce platoon role. They were acting in an ordinary rifle platoon role. But the characters within the platoon, particularly the corporals, were all very senior men. They'd been around for, 12 plus years, in some cases longer. The younger lads, some of the privates and lance corporals, they again, some of them were 20 and others were 26. And I was very much the baby at 18 and a half, commanding a platoon at 18 and a half. A daunting experience. But fortunately, Sergeant Robertson was a very calming influence, and I still have a very good relationship with Ian Robertson. We still see each other and speak to each other, and he ended up as a captain, having worked his way through the ranks, got to RSM and commissioned, and went on from there, and then decided to leave. And he now owns the remotest and probably one of the most successful pubs in Scotland at Knoydart. But I go out and see him occasionally, and we have a sort of a good laugh about old times. But the recce platoon was a rifle platoon, and I soon discovered that it's that during my time there, which is going to be, I think, I arrived sort of having done my platoon commander's battle course, I think it was September 1977, and we were going to be deployed from Palace Barracks to work with the gunners in Flack Street Mill in North Belfast, and we would be there until the end of the Gordon's tour, which was going to be beginning of May 1978. And sure enough, we deployed very shortly after that. So 2 days later, we deployed to Flack Street Mill, and that was going to be our home. We were going to get back 1 day a week, probably a Sunday, and for obvious reasons, because Ireland at that particular time, and I suppose it still is quite a religious country, there seemed to be less activity of a hostile nature on a Sunday than there was during the rest of the week. Saturday night could be a real devil, but by Sunday morning, 9 o'clock, we were normally trundling back from Flack Street Mill back to Palace Barracks, and have a, well, the boys normally had a few drinks, to say the least, and had a good meal, a good shower. And then we redeployed back to Flack Street Mill on the Monday morning very early to get there and be up and running by sort of 8:15. Flack Street Mill, well, a lot of folk who served in Belfast will know Flack Street Mill. It was, as its name suggests, an enormous old, rather insignificant building. It was just huge and grey, and I recall there were some red bricks all over the place. Security fence had been built around it that you couldn't see through, great big heavy iron gates with barbed wire everywhere. You couldn't see out of it, all the windows had been blocked off. If you wanted to see anything, you had to go upstairs onto the roof, onto the sangars upstairs. And the sangars themselves, of which I recall four at each corner of the building, all were interlocking and could see basically 360 degrees the way they were positioned, which is absolutely right. Looked into the Ardoin, which was the Catholic area that we were tasked to support. We were in there to support the gunners, whose TAOR, tactical area of responsibility, this was. And we worked with a number of 4-month rulement battalions coming through there, and we were the sort of permanent foot in the ground. That didn't mean for a minute, unfortunately, that we had an easier time. In many respects, I think the gunners felt that we being infantry, should be out quite often. And indeed, I would say we did at least 2 foot patrols each day, a minimum of 2 each day. And they would last anything between, the shortest one would be an hour and a half, but some could be 6 or 7 hours long, depending on what we were tasked to do. If you were sent out, for instance, on a lurk, you would be out for most of the night. You go out perhaps at 8:30, 9 o'clock, and you would watch perhaps certain pubs and see who was going in and who was coming out, and you'd spend most of the night lurking, as they say, in these areas. And it was, you know, I'm not sure how productive it actually was at the end of the day, but it was a foot on the ground. I'm quite sure that the folk of the Ardoyne knew where we were, knew what we were doing. This, of course, may have had a knock-on effect that they wouldn't do something that night because there were troops on the ground. On the other hand, on a certain occasions, it didn't happen to me personally, but it did happen to my platoon. They became a target for some of these things that are going on. On one occasion, it was a shooting target, which fortunately failed. But on other occasions, twice, for a bricking incident, which did work, and we had a couple of guys who were bricked and cut. But fortunately, you know, because Ardoyne, as you imagine, is not a huge area. It's quite a tout housing estate. You could easily, you know, say the word withdraw. You could flood the area with troops very quickly. You could move a pig from Flack Street Mill out into the Ardoyne in about a minute and pick up people within 2 or 3 minutes. So you could react quite quickly to these things and just stop it dead. So that's what we used to do. But more often than not, we went out and we would be in support of the artillery battery who was working in the area. And there were some good blokes. You know, we got on, we worked with, I forget the names of the actual names of the batteries now because they have such lovely names, but we worked with some Scottish gunners, we worked with some English gunners. But we all seemed to get on well because we were in there as a common cause. We were living in Flack Street Mill, which was not a five-star hotel. We lived down in the depths of this thing. It was like it was probably harking back to Victorian ages, where you had, you know, young boys and girls and whatever working in these, you know, dark, dismal holes in the bottom of these old buildings. And we lived in this sort of condition. And but you know, we knew it was only for a limited period of time. In our case, it was for 7 months. But the gunners knew they were there for 4 months, and they made it as homely as they could. To be fair to them, and you know, we were all part of this, and there was always some good banter in and around the mess hall, or there was a bar which was opened occasionally, which you allowed you 2 cans of beer. I recall, you had 2 cans of beer a day, and you couldn't drink them both together, and you had to be off duty. And I, you know, to this day, I'm not quite sure how that was ever sort of presided and watched over, but occasionally you'd find somebody who'd had more than 2 cans, put it that way, and they would be gripped. It was interesting experience. We had some shooting incidents in the Ardoyne. Particularly on foot patrol, it was an excellent place for people to fire into the Ardoyne, and you would have to watch and gauge the reaction of the public. And quite often when there were kids playing, you'd have to be aware that could be just a decoy, and then the kids would suddenly split and disappear, and there'd be a crack from a sniper rifle, maybe from 200 yards away, firing down one of these long streets, because the Ardoyne was on a slope, and you could easily fire down these long streets, and sure as 9 times out of 10, we were always at the bottom of the street, and therefore you had to run up the hill towards the point of contact. Or get people round the side, but they were always running uphill, which slowed them down, which meant that the sniper had an easier escape route. And you couldn't really preempt where an attack would take place. You couldn't say, right, I'm now in this area. There's definitely, you know, a window between sort of 11 o'clock and 4 o'clock where you could be shot at. There are various places in that arc. So therefore, let's get a vehicle beyond that. But how far beyond that do you put that vehicle to react and try and cut off the escape route? So there's a couple of incidents like that. Fortunately, I didn't lose anybody. The gunners did lose somebody. They lost a young Lance Bombardier who was shot, clean kill. And we never got anywhere near the people who did it, or the person who did it, but probably people. One person in the car, one person with the weapon, maybe even the weapon never came out of the house. Maybe the weapon was concealed in a house and disappeared, because they were very skilled at what they did, the IRA, very skilled. and you should never underestimate your enemy. You know, you can try and think like they do, but it's not always easy. And we of course had constraints upon us because we're acting in a way that you can't just, well, realistically, you can't just fire aimlessly anywhere when you've been engaged. I know it did happen. I know there was occasions where soldiers would fire indiscriminately in the air or at roofs or whatever, but on the whole, soldiers were very responsible, and they didn't do that. They identified where the shot came from. They tried to identify, you know, a slate off or a hole in the wall or a glass pane missing, and they would say it came from there. Now, it would still be 150, 200 yards away. So it's 9 times out of 10, shots were not returned unless you can identify the target. And that's something I think that you know, people should be aware of. It's not a simple and clean cut as, oh, bang, there's a shot, let's put down 60 bullets in that direction. You know, quite often we were with the traffic going around, the general noise in the place, you could not identify where it came from. And that made life very difficult. You couldn't necessarily send an accurate contact report because you just say, well, I've been shot out here, but where did it come from? Not a clue. And this, of course, would give the ops room, who are trying to support us and you know, get the right people in place to do something about it, they wouldn't have a clue, and therefore nothing happened, which is frustrating. Those members of the terrorist organisations who decided to take you on the street, which occasionally they did, it was a bit more clear-cut and you could return fire, and I know that the gunners certainly, and the Gordons, but not my platoon, returned fire and hit a car that had been used for a sniping incident. The car got away, but it was certainly had holes in it, and maybe one of the occupants was hit, but I don't know, because you just don't hear at the end of the day whether there's someone's been admitted to the hospital to get fixed up. So that was always something. We had lots of incidents where the dogs in the Ardoyne were all anti-British Army. They were all, anything green they would attack. You know, be that a Land Rover, be that a pig, be that us on foot. We were always being engaged by dogs. And the dogs would bark whenever you were walking up an alley, trying to move quietly between rows of houses up the alley, because the end of each Irish garden there was a gate, and you'd go into an alley where they put their bins, and just the communal sort of tip. The dogs would be in the walled gardens, and wherever you went, they'd bark the whole way along the line. So you couldn't move anywhere. But the dogs, if they were let out, they would have no hesitation but to go for you. And I'm afraid quite a few dogs were dealt a fatal blow, because they bit you. That then, of course, provoked immediately a reaction from the crowd, and you'd have dozens of people coming out on the street, very hostile. So the key thing was to try and calm it down, make sure you weren't a target, ask for backup, and then get the hell out of the place.
And what kind of dogs were these? Were these just like family pets, or do you think they were more of a guard nature? You know,
well, both, Arlene. They were family pets. But they tended to the air on the side of Alsatians, crosses, tended to be big dogs and not small yappies. These were big, yappy, biting dogs. But I think they were used for guarding premises. I mean, we shouldn't forget that quite a few people who lived in these estates were not all terrorist suspects. A lot of them were seriously decent people, that they were just living in an area which was just, you know, seen as inherently bad. But a lot of these folks were good folks, and they wanted to protect their own property. And of course, the IRA quite often killed their own, or killed people who were associated with somebody, but who perhaps had never committed a crime themselves, but by association were guilty of whatever. And it was tit for tat. So whilst they had a go at us, they also had a go at each other. And not just the IRA versus the IRA, Protestants would come in, because just across a road, you know, 12 metres away, there could be a whole Protestant housing estate. And they occasionally came across, and vice versa. There's one place just near there where they erected I say they, the authorities, erected a 25-metre-high wriggly tin fence, because these houses, one side of the street was Protestant, the other side was Catholic, and it was just a battleground. So they erected this 25-metre-high wriggly tin metal fence so they couldn't see each other. Didn't stop the big problems, but it did mean that you couldn't throw a brick from your front door through somebody else's window. So that these little things were set to try us. I don't think perhaps people on the mainland appreciate just how difficult things were for people living there, let alone for the British Army working with the Ulster Constabulary to try and keep the peace.
And when you said this fence as well, you know, this wall that they built, did they use it to annoy the other side or anything after that? Noise or anything?
There was always people using it like a set of drums. But I think after a while, everybody got fairly hacked off of that because it would go on all the time. So it became less of a problem. And what ultimately happened was, of course, it was decided that they had to move one set of the population out of the houses and rehouse them in other estates because they're building new estates. And they were rehoused. So there ended up being, let's say, a Protestant estate, the fence, and then there would be a row or two of houses that were not occupied by the Catholic side and the whole way down the street, and they were rehoused in a new estate within West Belfast. And I think that certainly calmed things down. But that didn't happen overnight. You know, that took several years to orchestrate that and build these houses and get the agreement of the locals who were going to be rehoused. Not easy. And some of them jumped at it. Some of them said, yeah, I'm quite happy to do that, because they didn't want to be part of what was going on. But others were a bit more dyed in the wool and entrenched, and this has been a family home for, you know, decades, and they didn't want to move. But, you know, that's the sort of thing that happened. And that's what you have to do, I suppose, in these situations. You have to try and reduce the opportunity for conflict, and sometimes it does mean rehousing people. As we've seen in other campaigns, I'm quite sure others you've spoken to will have said that, you know, in Malaya, for instance, they rehouse populations, they move people away so that the terrorists couldn't live on the back of decent people. So there was nothing new in what was going on in Northern Ireland. It may have seemed a little close to home, and oh my God, how could you do that? But actually, in a way of diffusing a situation, it is definitely a valid tactic.
And you've spoken about the houses there, and you've also spoken about the crowd, you know, when you were referring to the dogs.
Mm.
And I was wondering, what type of estate was it? You know, was it an old estate, or was it reasonably new? Or?
Oh, I would say, this was an old estate, Alan. It was, how can I best describe it? I have never personally watched Coronation Street, would you believe it, but I have seen the opening credits, where you've got these long rows of houses on a street. That's what it looked like. And I suppose the Ardoin itself would have been a housing estate that was maybe half a mile long by 600 yards wide. It wasn't big. It had, if my recollection is right, there were six streets, and a couple of intersections the whole way down. So it was a big rectangle. And we had deployed in that rectangle 140 men, you know, and it may seem like a lot, but by God, you can certainly, you know, easily absorb 140 men. And then you had people, normally, funny enough, from the Gordons, the resident battalion, would do the mobile patrols around the outside, because you could not put 140 men in there and 140 men in the next section and so on and so forth, because you'd absorb, you know, 10,000 people like that, and you're just making more targets, you're making life almost impossible for everybody, even for yourself moving around. So we tended to operate, but we were allocated to the Catholic areas. And that, of course, created its own set of problems. That's what we did.
And see, when you say there's 140 men as well, would that be 140 men at any one time, or would that be like how many men you had in total to police, if you like, that area?
No, the 140 is to police the area. There'd be a battery or a company of men in there. About 140 would be deployable onto the ground. There would be probably a further 40 or so who would be in barracks, in the mill, doing your cooking, collecting rations from places, collecting ammunition from wherever, depots. But those guys were not allocated on a daily basis to be out on the street. They did all the logistics stuff to make sure that the 140 men who were deployable were deployed. Now, I think only once that I recall, we had all 140 out at one go for a specific lift operation. But normally, there would be a minimum of 12 and a maximum of 60 out within that area, depending on what's going on. So you tended to work in bricks of four, and we'd always have three bricks out. So you'd have one moving, two stationary, and try working working round and through each other so that you had a foot on the ground and you had somebody moving. It didn't always work like that. 12 would more likely be out at night. During the day, numbers would increase. And you have your mobile patrols coming in to assist you as well, working on the flanks to try and prevent somebody having a go at you so they could get behind that person very quickly and hopefully prevent that person firing at you. Well, that was the principle behind it.
And you've mentioned these contact reports as well, when you were on the ground and things. So were you in close radio contact or something, with the likes of the vehicles and one another? And
yeah. We worked on it was an all-informed net. So I, as 5-3 platoon, as it was then, Recce platoon was 5-3, I was Sunray 5-3, platoon commander. I would have a radio going back to the ops officer in Flat Street Mill. Sometimes you had a second, I would have a radio on me, I might have a signaller with a radio that actually sent messages all the way back to the Gordons, who were in Palace Barracks, or to vehicles that were working around the area from the Gordons at Palace Barracks. But when you came into an area, you tended to go onto the same frequency, so that everybody within that area was speaking together. And you got a big list, a big sheet of paper with all the call signs on it, going from the commanding officer of that unit right the way down to, as we call them, the QWERTY, the colour sergeant, logistic colour sergeant, who was able to provide you with new socks or ammunition or hats or whatever you required. These guys had a call sign. So you weren't saying over the air, fetch me the quartermaster. You were saying, fetch me 29 Alpha. And that meant the quartermaster or whatever. but we had these small radios. I say small, but they weren't that small. In those days, we had 351s, we had 350s, and you worked your way up to a vehicle set, which was about the width of this table, like a big box, big suitcase called a C-42. These sets were big, bulky. They were not particularly good in the urban environment. And all the time, the Ministry of Defence and the experts in the logistic world were trying to create new sets. And eventually we did get a sort of small handheld set, probably the size of